muted, and I was muted. This is why we do live television, folks. At least I caught it. Welcome back. It's been a while. I'm rusty, as you can tell. I have a new system, but I'm figuring it out. And this is the Digital Orthodontist Live, as you can tell. This is the only live podcast in orthodontics, and that's why, because, you know, stuff goes weird when it's live. Tonight, I'm bringing you part one of an exciting two-part debate on the pros and cons of corporate orthodontics. Tonight's going to feature the perspective of a private practice orthodontist, Dr. Neil Kravitz, who will join me in just a few seconds. He's back there on the backstage area. I can see him smiling. And then we're going to film part two, which is the corporate orthodontic perspective with Jamie Reynolds, in a couple weeks. As a disclaimer, my goal is not to pump up corporate orthodontics. It's not also to tear it down. To be clear, I own my own orthodontic private practice. I have no goal or plans to join an OSO. And tonight's podcast has not been supported or initiated by a corporate orthodontic group. So why are we doing this? Well, that's a good question. I think that's a fair question. We're doing this because I like to cover topics that our profession often avoids. Tonight is a conversation. We are seeking truth, and we are not the world's experts on this topic, to say the least, but we're going to do our best to be fair and balanced and honest with some difficult questions along the way. And our opinions are just that, opinions. And we don't intend them to be taken as personal attacks. Ultimately, we just hope that our conversation sparks conversation among you and maybe helps answer some questions that you have. So, my guest tonight does not need an introduction, but we're going to give him one anyway. So let me bring him on. This is Dr. Neil Kravitz. Neil, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
Awesome. Seriously, thank you for being here. Here's your introduction. Tell me if this is right or wrong. He is the editor-in-chief of the JCO, the Journal of Clinical Orthodontics. He's a faculty member at the Harvard School of Dental Medicine. He's one of the busiest lecturers in orthodontics, and he's the owner of Kravitz Orthodontics. How did I mess up your last name? With two locations in Northern Virginia, Dr. Neil Kravitz. Yes.
Yeah.
Here comes the applause. There we go. Yeah. Took me a little while to get to the applause button. Again, I'm rusty here. Oh, and it played it again, you know? This is why you test stuff, you know? All right. So, as I mentioned tonight, Neil and I are going to discuss pros and cons of corporate orthodontics. We're going to look at specifically, is corporate ortho good for our profession? Is the future of corporate ortho bright or is it bleak? How will corporate ortho affect the future of private practice orthodontics? And then we're going to look at several, and I'm talking, we got like 20 questions tonight, so we're going to be on it. We're going to look at several specific doctor-submitted questions about OSOs. But first, I want to thank the audience who's out there. It looks like we've got somewhere around 70 right now, and I trust that that'll build as we go on. Thank you for tuning in. I know it's been a while since I've done this. I think it's actually been since last May. Please don't tell anyone on me there. But I want to encourage you, and this is important, I think, especially with a topic like this, to remain respectful and professional in the chat. We've never had, there's never been nudes in our chat, nothing like that. There's never been four-word expletives, but you never know. So you have to tell people, don't do that. Seriously, we're better than that. So I do want you, though, to comment. I want you to ask questions. We have a new feature where I can share comments, but due to privacy concerns with Meta, it won't show who asked it. So don't misuse that ability. This was Enrique Cruz I saw. He said, let's go. I appreciate that. But I can share your comments, as you just saw. So share away, and then we'll comment, and we'll speak through that. Our sponsor tonight is Neon Canvas. I co-founded that. So if you're looking for digital marketing, more new patients, let us know. But let's jump into this thing. Neil, let's jump in with kind of a little bit of an intro question. And I think it's always good when we're talking about a topic. I think corporate orthodontics is something that we all think we understand, but I think it's always a little more complex, let's say. And so I want to ask you, tell me what corporate orthodontics, again, is a non-expert, but as an orthodontist, let's be honest, that knows a lot, that talks a lot to a lot of people, that's, you know, a student of orthodontics, let's say. Tell me maybe how it's different from DSOs, and then maybe what kind of support OSOs offer.
Sure, sure. I think defining these terms are actually harder than you might think. We're working on a paper on this for the JCO, and even coming up with basic definitions is challenging because in many ways, orthodontists who own multiple satellites could in many ways be considered a corporation. But when we think about corporate orthodontists, when we think about dental service organizations and orthodontic service organizations and corporations, we're talking about a consolidation of offices to alleviate administrative duties. And now, even though all OSOs do not use private equity, when I think when we consider corporate orthodontics, we're really talking about the involvement of Wall Street in orthodontic offices. And I think that's kind of where corporations are. And a DSO would be a dental service organization or a corporation that's primarily dental focused, though those DSOs can hire orthodontists and specialists. That was my experience. And I'll talk about the challenges of that type of employment. And then an OSO would be one that's specified just for orthodontics.
Yeah, no, I think that answers it really well. You know, I have, one comment I want to respond to. It's, Mike DePascal or DePascali. I don't know how to, it's the thing about Facebook is I don't know how to pronounce anyone's name, but he said that mug is wild. And I do have to give a shout out. This is, my old faithful mug. This is the donut juice mug. Anyway, sorry that this is already off the rails. Nils, like, I thought we were doing something serious here. No, I'm just kidding. I want to share a couple slides too, that I think will kind of help to, set the stage, as it were, and then we'll get into, you know, the more difficult questions. This is actually from Benson Koppel and Associates, who I think, you know, a really great source of information and a trusted source of information. Shannon Patterson, she's the one that's responsible for this data, and these are her slides. But I just thought it was kind of interesting because when we talk about, like, how big are OSOs, where are they big, and also one of the things that will come tonight is, you know, how are they perceived by residents? Because, you know, Neil, I don't know how long it was for you since you went to residency, but it's been 11 years for me. You don't have to answer, you know, but it's, you know, it's been a while, right? So things have changed. I was not familiar at all with corporate orthodontics other than when people talk about OCA, which we'll talk about here in a second. But yeah, as you can see right here, the most popular states are the ones there in that kind of burnt orange color, Texas and Colorado, and how good is my geography, you know? But then it kind of goes down, and there's some of the states that you might expect, like not a lot of corporate orthodontics taking place in Hawaii and Alaska, unfortunately, and Maine and so on. But so there's that, and that's DSOs, I should say. By specialty affiliation, this may be interesting to you, but in the DSO world, orthodontics is actually the most represented specialty. Least represented specialty, they didn't even put it on here. It's, what do you call that, like oral path, you know? That's not on here. Not a lot of corporate interest in oral pathology. Okay. But no, prosthodontics. You know, a lot of oral and maxillofacial, a lot of GP, endo, what you would expect, pediatrics, but orthodontics is number one. This is interesting. And this, I think, fits because I went to dental school. When did I graduate? 2010, I guess, and 13 from orthodontics. It looks like that is more than doubled in terms of dental school seniors who plan to join a DSO practice, from 12% in 2015 all the way up to 30% just in 5 years. Probably has even gone up since then. Gen Z, what generation are you? Are you Gen X?
Yeah, we're the latchkey generation, right?
I'm sort of a millennial who pretends to be something else on occasion. But what you'll see here is that effectively an increasing number of the younger generation plan to go into DSO or OSO affiliated practice. Now, what's also interesting, though, is that there's still a high percentage that plan to, as you see there, 40% find an associate position on a private practice, which is kind of the perspective that we're bringing tonight. But there's a good 30% there who plan to go into OSO DSO world. And there's still that crazy, 4% who want to start their own practice like me, and the 6% that want to buy an established practice, and somehow 0% want to join a pediatric or group practice. Go figure. Here's an interesting one, and then we'll move on from the slides back into some questions, but I do think this kind of helps to look at the norms here. But how orthodontic residents feel about private equity purchasing existing orthodontic practices in the industry? Only 14% think it's good or would say that it's good. 41% say they're disappointed. And then 45%, so a total of, you know, roughly 85%, 86%, say it's a good option for my first job, but I still plan on owning my own private practice one day. So I think that would say that, and it's funny, it lands at, you mentioned even like the 85% that are in private practice. I think that that holds. I think that probably 85% still view orthodontics as a profession by which you end up as a private practitioner and so on. And I think this is my last one, just to kind of, you know, bring this home, is DSOs, there's a lot of turnover. Okay, so the associate turnover rate, this is in DSOs, not just OSOs, but is a little less than 18 months, for whatever that's worth. Okay, so, you know, take statistics for what they are. I just thought it would kind of help get us started down that road. And I think now it's time to move into some more difficult questions, if you're ready. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm ready. Fire away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, right. I think.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I think, listen, I think this is challenging in many ways for me to be on this because this is certainly not my expertise. But I think it's important for residents and young doctors to hear maybe the perspective of the doctor in private practice, because I think just from feel that over the last few years, the doctor in private practice, even if they do make up the majority, sure doesn't feel like it. And I think in many ways, one of the goals that I'd like to try to do is to share the upside about working in private practice. I hope that comes across. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a goal. And just so you guys know, like, this was supposed to be a two-person debate. And when I say I had scheduling conflicts, we had scheduling conflicts. It's just hard to get two people sometimes on the same thing. And I think there would have been some pluses and minuses to that. I think where Neil and I are maybe a little concerned is just that it will feel like an outright criticism or like we're trying to beat up or you know, that's really not it. It's just a conversation that just hasn't happened. And to be honest, the conversations around corporate orthodontics have largely been people in corporate orthodontics, you know? So it's like if 85% or so of our profession is private practitioners, I think it's fair to have that conversation and just know we aren't trying to be personal. I've already made one disclaimer. What's two, you know? So let's jump into this. The second question is, you know, I think anytime the topic of corporate ortho comes up, if and when it came up in my residency, it was not long before someone brought up Gaspar Lazzara, brought up Orthodontic Centers of America, OCA, and so on. If you're not familiar with that, go look it up. But the narrative that I hear today, which I think makes sense, is that, well, today's groups are different. They're very different than the ones that failed in the 80s and 90s, and they're going to be successful and so on. Do you think that that's true?
It's tough, right? I mean, it depends who you ask, because, right, Lazzara started that in 85, and then you have, you know, Apple Orthodontics. You know, Lazzara was really the beginning of corporate orthodontics, and then, you know, 10, 11 years later in 96 with Rick Workman and Heartland Dental Care, doing it with dental offices. And depending who you talk about, they say this is exactly what they experienced, because when I was a resident, OSAs were very big, and many of the state laws now that we have that really define and limit what corporate dentistry can be for that state were based on lawsuits against OSA. So it is hard to tell if corporations will follow the same path that OSAs did and dissolve. But, you know, my gut feeling, and I know we'll get probably into this later, is that percentage of 15% to 20% will be pretty consistent. And we've seen that in dentistry and everywhere. I think it's going to be hard for corporations to surpass that. I don't think you're going to see a landscape where it'll be 50% corporate orthodontics. So do I think corporations will outlast or last longer than OSAs? I think so. But I don't know if they'll continue to grow at the rate that they're growing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think we'll see the general dental world be a very different story. And I think, at least as I perceive it, and again, not the world's expert, I'm going to stop giving that caveat. I spent a lot of time on this topic, and if I'm wrong, someone's going to tell me. But, you know, in the dental world, it is more predicated around insurance. And I do think that at scale, I think a corporate group or groups can leverage interest more than what we can in a fee-for-service largely profession like orthodontics. So I think it's different in a very key way in that way. And so, you know, our DSO is headed towards 40, 50%, whatever. I don't know, maybe. I don't see that with orthodontics, but I don't see it going away. And I think we have a lot more groups. We have a lot more private equity money. That money has been very inexpensive the last few years. And so I think we're going to see, like what you said is a really good way of saying it. I want to stop just to say this. I'm seeing this question. How do you define success? And I think that's great, because I think we should probably get that out of the way too. And let me answer this in that success is what you want it to be. You know, success is not making the most money. Success is not speaking the most times in a single year. It's not, you know, publishing the most papers. It's not, you know, being the, you know, the chair of a program. It could be those things, and it could very well not be. What success is ultimately is going to be defined by you. And so obviously what is going to be maybe more our perspective is, I think it's great to own my own practice and make good money and be able to employ my own team and be autonomous and so on and so forth. Maybe Neil and I have more similar personalities than you do. You may only want to work 2 days a week and have a lifestyle practice. And in that sense, you want to be an associate for the rest of your life. And so in that way, like, that kind of flips it on its head. And that's why these perspectives differ. And that's why this conversation, I think, is important. So again, I'll also say
my definition of success kind of changed as I kind of grew up a little bit. I've shared this story many times, but when I started at the DSO, and my success was based on practice growth, the number of starts and collection, and my rank within the company. They ranked you based on your collection. Man. And I really judged my success. And when I would lecture, I would talk about those numbers, trying to validate myself as a young speaker. And then I kind of said, my success is based on the quality of work I'm doing, and I wasn't really doing great work, and I had to kind of refocus a little bit. So you're right. I think as we change, our feelings of success will change. And, you know, sometimes I really feel like a successful day for me at my office is not just a high collection day, but it's a low stress day. Like, I really, you know, a day where I make a lot of money, but it's very stressful, is not a successful day. Or a day where we do very well in the office, but I'm not good at home, that's not a successful day. So I think it's a great question, and it's continually evolving.
Yeah, I'm with you. And there's so much more that could be said about that. All right, so let's move on into question three. This one's going to come out of like a cannonball here, but DSOs often get accused of being like pyramid schemes. I hear people say that all the time. You know, it's a shell game. It's mid-level marketing, blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying I agree with all that. This is a question, okay? Don't, you know. These are criticisms and common objections of OSOs. That's what this section of questions is. Okay, so the idea is that those that get in first reap the big benefits, but the doctors who sell their practices later will inevitably get less benefit from the partnership. Do you think that's a fair criticism? What do you think about that?
So this is like a hard question. It's a sensitive question, and it's certainly one where we're not trying to create any division. But I think if I can kind of reword it, and I think where the term pyramid scheme is coming from, is I think people feel that the numbers don't add up, right? So, and again, I'm just guessing here, right? This is not, you know, I'm not in this world. For example, Kyle, if a corporation comes to your practice and wants to purchase your office for $15 million, and they also then want to pay you a salary, and then we have to assume that your collection drops a little bit because you're not going to be working as much, it's going to take them 20 years to turn a profit. So the question when people start doing the math is, are any of these entities as a whole profitable, or are they just continually borrowing money from private equity and only building up a portfolio and then just reselling? And that's where this idea comes from. When people say the math doesn't make sense, anybody who's hired one or two associates know how much that affects your office, let alone buying out a practice for an exorbitant fee. So I think that's where that term, I know it's a hard term, and I think there is some validation because you are starting to see some DSOs fold, and you're starting to see high debt, billions of dollars of debt, and you're starting to see the private equity groups get paid while the corporations assume more risk. So I don't know to answer the question specifically. I want to make sure I'm answering the question. I think it's a harsh criticism, but I think where it's coming from, and I think I can maybe answer that one better and safer, is to say that I think people who look on the outside don't understand how any of these entities make money. At some point, you know, the check will be due. At some point, the bill, the note will be due. And I think what will happen would be some of these offices will start closing and start reselling back toward private practice. You're right. Those at the very top who sit at the table, those are the ones that make money. And those at the end, those stock options won't be there. and those bonuses won't be there. And I think some of those incentives won't be there. And again, just guessing, but I'm not sure how any of the math makes sense. And or in, as orthodontists, we do these numbers in our head all day long. I just don't see how even the purchase of one major practice for $15 million or more can ever generate a profit within 10 to 15 years. I think it would even take longer than that, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is a tough one. Why didn't I put this one later? because it feels like an outright criticism.
But I don't know. I'm trying to answer it, and I hope I'm doing okay for everybody. I'm trying to do my best. This is a challenging. I'm happy we're having this conversation. I'm happy to kind of jump on the landmine, but I hope I'm doing okay. Yeah,
you're good. We're jumping on it together. I think, you know, some people want the Tommy gun answer, and then some people want like the highly politicized answer. I think you're doing a great job to balance it. I would just say it's just difficult. We don't know. We've not watched the end of the movie or read the end of the book. I think there's some common sense, I think, that probably applies to some of this. And I think you've already, you know, you hear the stories, especially when you bring up, hey, I'm doing a corporate orthodontics podcast. You get the people immediately, you know, in your ear, private messaging you the horror stories of, well, I was supposed to get this bonus. I'm no longer getting that. Or my team didn't get their paycheck. And these are extreme examples. And let me also say, if you're out there and you work for corporate orthodontics, has this same thing happened to private practicing orthodontists who get over-leveraged? Of course. There's people that open too many practices. They start to live too lavish a lifestyle. They buy three boats and they can't afford even two of them. You know, like these things happen. People don't get paid. I mean, we've heard all these stories. People go bankrupt. You see this in different ways. I'm not equating that to what's happening in corporate orthodontics. But at a certain point, you have to pay the piper. It's going to happen. And so I think, you know, given high interest rate, I think also given that, you know, the highest kind of high water mark for corporate orthodontic sales was like 2022. And coming right out of COVID, you know, 2020, 2021, orthodontics was on fire. And I think you ask anybody who's honest, you look at the, you know, the gauge data and the, you know, the data from the JCO, y'all do it too. It's a little softer now. Consumer spending behavior is down. And so, you know, orthodontic practices that are mature probably, you know, in the average of 2-4% of growth over, you know, year over year. But if you sold at this idea that it was 15-20% of growth, that changes those metrics and that math. So anyway, we'll get into more of this, but go ahead, finish this one up if you don't mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, the way I would put it is I'm not quite sure I understand how the math works. And I think about it all the time. And I think at some point, people will have to start collecting, and what we'll start to see in my experience, when I worked at the DSO, when I worked at Heartland, it was not uncommon for them to close 20 or 30 offices in a year. If those became non-profitable offices, and you're starting to see what we've had two DSOs in the last month. One restructure, and then another one fire their CEO. There are some clear cracks in the wall.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to this. And again, subjective question. And I should say some of these have been sourced from other people that have curiosity questions. But you started your career, as you alluded to, in a DSO. And you've no doubt had lots of conversations like I have with doctors and team members who've both worked in corporate orthodontics and corporate dental. And again, they're not all created equally, let's say, but there's similarities. In your experience, would you say that work satisfaction by the doctor and staff improve, stay the same, or decrease after selling their practice to a corporation?
Yeah. So let me just, cause there's two parts to this that I really want to answer. This is going to be my best guess just from talking to colleagues and just also kind of having second consults come into my practice. I thoroughly, even though I don't recommend working at a DSO, and I'd love to make sure we have time to cover that for the young doctors who are here. Sometimes you just have to work where you can. I was coming from an out-of-state residency and it was hard to find employment. And I really love the doctor who hired me. And I when his smaller corporation sold to a larger corporation, I liked the experience a little bit less. But here's what I will tell you. Does the satisfaction of the doctor improve? I don't know if it imp- I don't think it improves, but I don't. I think from my experience, they think they're going to be working less, and they are working much more because, from what I've been told, many of their staff leave because of one of the ways the corporations recuperate expense is by decreasing staff salaries. So many of the staff leave. I think many doctors will tell you, I've experienced this, that when a corporation purchases a practice, a lot of those staff start looking for work, and they're looking around. So a lot of staff leave. So a lot of times these doctors, even though they may be working less days per month, are working very hard, busy days. So, you know, I think the money helps. But I don't think their job is any easier. You know, the model that a corporation will tell you is that we'll handle the administrative duties. And as Heartland would say, their tagline, you go ahead and be the doctor again. But that was not my experience. If you work at a DSO, you are still going to have all of the duties of a doctor in private practice. And if you think you can just tell a patient, just talk to my regional manager every time I have a problem, that office will be on the wrong side of Yelp. And those that do not treat a corporate office like a private practice immediately get affected on Yelp. And you can just see it happening because that doctor is not there to stomp the fire when it happens. And so, you know, does the doctor satisfaction? I don't know. Does staff satisfaction? I would believe that staff satisfaction goes down, in my opinion. I believe they're paid less, they work harder, they're frequently understaffed. And again, I'm answering this as best as I can from what I hear from many colleagues. And I'm very open if people have had a different experience.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this. I think I've heard every variation of the answer you could give to this. I think the hard thing with this conversation is when you are incentivized based on the success of your organization to say that it's good, what do you expect? And I think you just have to say that. I mean, that's just sort of the reality of the situation.
I have no bad judgment of an orthodontist who toes a company line. I think that's how I was raised. You should be an ambassador for your college, for your family, for your university, you know, for your residency program. I get that. I hope in many ways this conversation, though it's challenging to give, maybe just gives a different perspective and one that I hope comes from the heart.
Yeah. But I will say, even though that's always like in the back of my mind, I know that there's plenty of people that are really happy with it. I know that for some of them, they felt buried under certain aspects of practice, or that there was a good reason why they wanted to sell or wanted to join. They appreciate the, you know, the camaraderie of the group. And again, every group's a little bit different. There are some staff that, you know, kind of hearing stories that did get paid more, that got an opportunity to take on a role with greater responsibility and so on. So, you know, I think we want to avoid painting with too broad a brush, and I'm not trying to dispute what you say. But again, we only have so many, you know, our sample size only runs so deep. So I have to assume there's some of those examples. At the same time, I've heard plenty of stories of people come tell me, like, you know, I sold and then a couple years later, I only had, you know, 10% of my team left, you know. I don't know if that's more of a criticism of them or of the model or what, you know.
The best part of our job is being the owner. I mean that is the best part of being in private practice. That aspect I would never give up.
Yeah. Now you wouldn't, and I wouldn't, and some people would, you know. So all right, let's jump onto this one, and then we'll get into a different section. Actually, we're going to get into a section beating up on private practice a little bit. So if you're hating this part, you know you'll like the next part. So, all right. So here's maybe a little bit quicker one. This is a common concern that comes up. Again, these are common criticisms, objections to OSOs, not necessarily ours. We're trying to do our best to speak to them honestly, but a really common concern: if I sell my practice to an OSO, how many changes should I expect to see? I think the official word is nothing's going to change, right? Except the things that will be better, the support that we'll offer, and so on. But the question is, will there be changes in brackets, aligner systems, hours worked? What about healthcare options, payroll, practice management systems? And secondly, do these promises made in earnest at the point of signing up and selling, do they ever change, or do you foresee them changing?
So I'll tell you a great story. When I So when I was at the DSO and I had this great owner, we had a very small, I describe my love for this owner. We had a very private wedding, my wife and I had this vision of a very kind of boutique wedding with just a small number of guests. And one of them was this owner. So clearly he was very much part of our family. But I remember when he sold his small corporation to this larger corporation and I had some concerns, he looked at me and said, "Neil, it ain't my business anymore." You know what I mean? So like what I'm going to tell you is that, I guess they can do all of that. They're going to change brackets. I'm just going to say my opinion here. I hope it's okay to say this, but in my experience, guys, when offices sell to a corporation, the easiest sign that you know that the guy up the street sold to a corporation is they immediately begin overselling Invisalign and they become scan center like. They start doing Invisalign on anyone and everyone because, again, the doctor is going to be less present. It's less, it's more innocuous type treatment. It's more delegated treatment. So, in my humble opinion, most doctors who have sold to corporations near me have turned their practice into primarily Invisalign based practices. And I think if you are an office that maybe is not doing Invisalign and you sell to a corporation, you'll start doing much more Invisalign, I think. And if you're an office that does a lot of Invisalign, you're probably very appealing to those offices anyways. But I think that's one of the changes that you should expect. And if you sell your practice, how many changes do you expect? Yeah, all of them. I think you should expect anything. What is kept is your name only. But I got to tell you something. If I sell my practice to a corporation and I'm only working 8 days a month because instead of making, $50,000 a day, I make $1,500 a day, well, I'm not going to go to work. I'm only going to work 8 days a month, which is what happens. I become disinterested. And all of a sudden, Kravitz Orthodontics without Kravitz isn't really Kravitz Orthodontics. So I think how many changes should you expect? I think it's going to be a lot. And I think the patients notice it too. And they'll notice it the moment they get that first bill with the corporate's name on the statement. I think you should be open to all and every change that could be coming.
Yeah. And this is where it would be nice, as a debate goes, like to have someone with a different perspective, because I do know other people that are in corporate that would, I'm sure, vociferously say that's not true. That's not been my experience. And not to be, semantics based, but they'd say, well, I don't do any Invisalign. I do Spark so I think you mean generally clear aligner treatment. I understand what you're saying. I don't know that that's always true. I think of, I'm just going to call out a name. Sorry to this person, but Stuart Frost, David
Sarno. They don't do any.
They probably do some, but not a significant amount. I know for a fact David Sarno is mostly braces. Okay, sorry, David, for using your name. But so it's not always true, but there is that potential. I think we all know on some level that at least in certain DSO realms, that has been true, that we know that they've leveraged for better pricing on Invisalign, and I've seen that happen in my community. So again, I don't know that that's like a truism in the sense that it's absolutely true, but...
I'm not saying it in a terms of a critique. You understand that hand and glove fit between corporate orthodontics and Invisalign-based treatment. It makes perfect sense with that model. It really does. But if we're asking how a practice will change, I think a very true answer that would be hard to really argue against is that they'll be doing much more clear aligner therapy.
Yeah. So what I would say, not knowing, not going through the process, I would say put whatever you don't want changed in a contract. put it as black and white as you can. If there's something it's non-negotiable for you. And I've heard of people doing that, like, I want to keep this consultant for this, number, and they'll negotiate that out. If it's in writing, it's going to be the case. But if it's something is made, from a handshake in any business situation, that's only going to be so good. I've heard of plenty that are still able to order what they want and still have autonomy. And I've heard of other examples where that's not the case. So we'll leave that one at that. I think there's probably some variety of answer there. And again, we plan to come back and we plan to get the corporate orthodontic opinion on this and see.
I think here's what I'd like to kind of say in terms of this. Yeah. It may not be I think what is going to happen is there is going to be, whether direct or indirect, in my experience working at the DSO, a pressure toward treatment. So, right, someone may not come in, or they may come in and tell you, you should have started this case. But I felt that it was a atmosphere that was conducive to starting today. You must start today. Treatment must happen now. If you're a consult, then you must want to get started. And I felt that that it really took that side of us, right, that competitive gunner side, and it really it turned that up a notch. And it really kind of had that investment banker mentality that I had to deprogram. And I think so maybe they don't dictate the specific bracket, but I think there is going to be a cultural movement toward maybe a little bit more proactive treatment. That's my humble experience.
Yeah, that's right on. All right, let's shift on into this. And I think I said that we'd take 15 minutes on that, and we took, 30. That's just me and Neil together. You just have to learn to accept that. We're going to talk. Let's jump into this. And this is, I just want to be honest with this conversation. I said, to be fair, private practice orthodontics isn't all rainbows and unicorns. And so if I'm on the corporate orthodontic side, and I'm listening to two private practice guys talk and, be not self-deprecating, but, deprecate corporate orthodontics, I'm thinking, what about X, Y, and Z? Well, let's talk about some of those. One of the most common things that I've heard people say is joining corporate orthodontics, it allowed me to give these great benefits to my team, which I'm going to be honest, when I hear that, it's like, what was stopping you before? But let's look at this from this perspective. One thing, and this is for me at least, that OSOs have illuminated is that some private practice orthodontists weren't providing their teams with standard job benefits as I see them, like health insurance, 401k plans, or even competitive wages with cost of living raises. I think we've all heard those stories. I'm not saying that that's unique to every private practice or that it's necessarily worse than corporate. I don't know that. I just know that that's true of some. And so I would say this, Neil, just a question to you is that obviously these decisions are subjective and they're up to the individual totally. Business owner. But what are some aspects? Let's find a positive spin on this. What are some aspects that we can learn from as private practitioners?
I want to say a few things. I'm not trying to just critique. It's hard because I'm really trying as best I can to share the benefits of being in private practice. But to answer your question specifically, I will say that nobody is going to care for their staff more than a doctor in private practice. My staff are my extended family. My office managers, are family members. My team has been with me for almost 17 years, the majority of them. The office managers, the people who run my practice, they almost make six-figure salaries. People do 401k. We have the best insurance, the insurance that I have for my family. Whatever they want and need, we do. I don't know how a corporation can compete with me in terms of taking care of my staff member. When someone comes to me and asks for a raise or anything, a uniform, anything, that is done within minutes. And I would hope that the doctor in private practice who really has developed this long-term relationship with their staff takes care of their staff better than a corporation. You can argue that a corporation with many, many employees just simply could not provide the benefits that a smaller doctor could. Because when I have a staff member and I want to pay them $35 an hour, which is, 70 something thousand dollars a year or more, and people go, well, how can you pay that staff member that salary? I go, well, I go home and go, what's it worth not having this staff member in my life? And I can't come up with a number. So I would hope that the doctor in private practice could provide for their staff better than a corporation. I could be wrong with that, but at least let me say this, at least an experienced doctor in private practice, maybe not your first 5 or 10 years, I get it, but if you've been practicing for 10 to 15 years, you should be doing those things. Our job is to make our employees' lives better for them and take care of their families, put their kids through school. So that's my little message to the doctor in private practice. I think what can doctors in private practice learn from corporations? Well, I think maybe negotiating with insurance companies. You know, I think, listen, there's a lot of different models, and I think we need to be open to saying that there's many different ways. Maybe let's just be frank. Maybe they need to be open to doing more Invisalign. I think that's fair. I think there's pros to both corporate and private.
Do you not do aligners, Neil? I'm ribbing you a little bit.
Yeah. So we have about 25% of my practice is Invisalign. So millions of dollars of overhead a year.
Yeah. Mine's right at around 20% or so as well. So obviously there's a place for it. I just wanted to clarify that because I know you do some. And I would say to this question, I don't know that this is like a great question in the sense that I don't know what I've not stepped in all, 8,000 private practices, let's say. I just hear this come up a lot. It's like, well, I've been able to offer my staff, better benefits, they're happier, yada, yada. It's like, well, what's keeping you from doing this? So I would just say this, and we don't need to say anything more about this topic, but if you're not offering health insurance to your team, if you're not offering like 401k and some of these other benefits, look into it. It's not that difficult. Find a financial expert. They will be happy to set that up for you in your office. Okay. All right. So let's jump into this. This is another one about private practice orthodontics. Coming into orthodontics, I didn't buy a practice. I started one from scratch. Terrible financial idea, by the way, but it worked out. I've always heard that a fair sale price for practice would be about 100% of last year's collections, give or take, right? OSOs, DSOs have been paying multiples of 5 to 9 times of EBITDA, which has like become this big buzzword. I never heard the acronym EBITDA until, 7 years ago, and now it's all I hear. Or you could equate that to something like maybe 2 to 3 times of collections. It's a massive difference, right? And we've talked about this. Do you think that traditional valuations for private practices were too low?
Yeah, maybe, certainly. I mean, that's one of the great values that corporations have maybe brought to our profession. But again, the idea of selling your practice is also to hand it off to a young orthodontist. And even if my office is doing, X number of millions of dollars, how much can I sell it to realistically expect a young associate to purchase it from? Because I could never sell it for the value because that it's just, it's unrealistic to think that they could purchase it for that price. So I think one of the great benefits we might find is that doctors who sell their private practice to other orthodontists may now get more than they would have before the corporate landscape. And I think that's great for everybody, except, and I think the person who always is getting hurt here is the young orthodontist. The young orthodontist who is looking for a doctor who's going to sell their practice. And now that doctor who's going to sell their practice may want somewhere in between what they were asking and what a corporation's asking. So this is a hard time to be a young orthodontist wanting to purchase a practice. They're the ones that get hurt.
Yep. And I think it reaches a point, obviously, where banks are not going to finance it, at a certain point. And so that I worry about that because I was able to, basically walk up to my Bank of America, friendly practice solutions expert and say, I want to start a practice. They're like, sure, sign here. I don't know that will be the case, And then we talk about student debt, and we'll get into some of that later when we talk about residents in particular. So if you're a resident, stay with us. All right, one more thing on this session.
I hope I'm doing okay. This is a tight wire to walk.
I think you're doing great.
Okay.
Look.
I'm open to criticism. I can read the comments, so I'm open to it as best I can.
No. You do not read the comments, Neil. This is like reading when you do a CE course. You never read the responses or the opinions because there's always
like
were you listening to my lecture? You hated it that bad? No, you're doing awesome. And look, guys and gals, we know this is not an easy topic. We're trying to do the best we can and do it the credit it deserves. I'm going to come back around and do one with a corporate orthodontic person. So if you hate everything that we're saying, and I'm not trying to be in one camp or the other. I'm trying to moderate this as fairly as I can. And Neil's trying to be fair too. So, all right. Well, that's like our 7th caveat. All right. So here's another accusation that I hear. And this is a big one. This is a tough one. But I think it's an important one. This came up more than anything else. This is an accusation that I hear is that clinical quality or standard of care is lower in a corporate setting. But I have to be honest, again, I got to play devil's advocate here to that, is that we have all seen very bad cases floating around from private practicing orthodontists. And I even put in italics, some of them might even be ours. You know, I've had bad cases, right? So let me ask this. Here's the question. Do you think that clinical quality is, on average, better, worse, or the same in a corporate office compared to that of a private office?
So this is the great question. I think for DSOs, it's far worse. I don't know anybody who is going to recommend their family to go to a dentist in a corporation. I think corporate dental is over treatment and over sells. These are the doctors that are telling patients they have cracks in their enamel and doing crowns, which become extracted teeth, which become implants, and the cascade that follows. For orthodontics, I wouldn't say that I've seen the quality lesson. I don't sense that. But here's what I will tell you. It's different because the main doctor isn't there, right? So I think it's not a quality issue. I think what you're seeing is a significant patient dissatisfaction issue because they keep saying, well, the doctor's always on vacation. I'm like, hun, he ain't coming back. The doctor ain't coming back. It ain't vacation. It's the perma vacation. Okay. You know, so the office has been sold. So it's just, I would not say the quality is worse. I am the first person who will scream at the top of his lungs that I have made so many clinical mistakes and I have so much regret. And I am never anyone to pass any judgment on clinical mistakes. But what I've experienced from my office, from patients who have come in and we have to redirect them back to that practice, is that they are saddened by really the owner not being present the way they were.
Okay, right on. I think probably like the most important aspect of this, if I could put a finger on it, that might impact corporate orthodontics more than that of private practice is continuity of care. And I think that's an important concept to bring up. And this is, you know, we're not talking like life or death here. I take clinical orthodontics very, very seriously. You know, it's a subjective conversation. What's good orthodontics? What's bad orthodontics? It is easy to judge someone else's orthodontics like a Monday morning quarterback. I mean, these are all like really important conversations that have been parsed out and spoken through. But I do think that we have to have a serious conversation about continuity of care. Is that going to be greater on average in private practice? Or is that going to be greater on average in corporate orthodontics? I think we have to just say, well, it's going to be greater on average in private practice.
Yeah.
Literally.
I think what corporations fear, and I think what is happening, and we talked about this with the money factor, is that if a doctor sells and they sold for a good amount and they want a salary, and that salary is set at $1,250 a day or $1,500 a day, and they're used to making $15,000 a day or $20,000 a day or much more, they're going to say, well, why come into work? I'm only going to work for 6 to 8 days a month, which is what I've been told that they do. And that's where things start to fall apart, because you know, as a private practice, if you're not present even one day a week, there are problems. Even if you go give a lecture, you're dealing with things on the phone. Imagine only being present for a short period of time. And I think the biggest concern with corporations is the owner becomes disengaged. And some will say that does not happen. That absolutely happens. The owner is out. I actually think they don't only become disengaged in their practice. I think they become disengaged in their profession. I really do. And that's okay, rightfully so. They've sold their company, and I think they can spend time with family and do the things that maybe they haven't been able to. So I'm not critiquing that, but I do think that that is happening.
I think that that is very apparent in the Facebook groups, when I've seen people who are very active on Facebook, which is only representative of so much, and people come in and out of social media, but upon selling, sometimes they sort of disappear. Now, that's not true of everyone. And again, I have to come back to Stuart Frost again, because his clinical cases crush mine. You know, he's going to kill me, you know, 6 days of Sunday.
100%. 100%.
So I think that a challenge that corporate orthodontics is going to have to figure out is how to keep highly engaged and bought in orthodontists in those positions, because I do think that if it becomes a revolving door, like what we see with the DSO model now, you know, couple decades on is, I mean, how many of us would take our kids to a DSO for their dental work?
None. None. I mean, in capital letters, none. And I think that's something to really sit on.
Yeah. All right. So let's shift into doctor submitted questions. I feel like I should have a drum roll here. There were so many submitted questions, Neil. There's no way we could answer them all. And if you're keeping track of time, we are going over an hour. I hope that's okay. Hope
I'm okay. If everyone's else okay, I'll stay if everybody's okay.
Yeah. We've got a biggest audience we've ever had for this show, you know, 6 years into this thing. And I got to say, I'm wearing a suit jacket, but I've got shorts on, so I feel good. So I got, you'll never see it, but it's true. Okay, so here we go. I had dozens of questions submitted over the past few weeks. We're going to try to get through these again. And this is the last time I'm going to say it, maybe. People in the chat were saying, stop being defensive and stop apologizing. Just do your thing. So were they giving us permission, Neil? But these answers represent Neil's unique perspective, and I'll chime in. you know, part two of this debate will feature very different answers, I'm sure. All right. So here's a big one. Residents, if you're out there, I'm a resident and I graduate in a few months. Should I work for a DSO or OSO or not?
Yeah, I think my preference would always be, you know, to work for a doctor in private practice, obviously first, and then second for an OSO. And, you know, I'd love it if you could work for a doctor in private practice to also get that perspective, even part-time, that may not be possible. And then I think the last option should be a DSO, which is what I did. You know, on day one, I was seeing 150 patients a day as a 26-year-old, and I was not equipped for it, and I did not understand what it meant to be an orthodontist. And I just really developed a lot of bad habits. So I think the challenge of a DSO is the lack of mentorship. You're going to be on your own right away. You're going to learn business before you learn orthodontics. So first and foremost, you just have to get a job. And I was coming from out of state and it was hard to find work. I've tried to create a Facebook group to help people get employment. I've really made it like a personal mission to try to find jobs for associates. So if you're interested in coming to Virginia or Maryland, send me a message and I will do my best to help you try to find work. But I think you have to do the best you can to find work. And it's easy to find work at DSOs because of that revolving door. I will tell you, DSOs don't like specialists because it's very stressful for them to have a specialist because it's hard to replace them, which is why a lot of them do their own Invisalign when they shouldn't be rather than refer out. So I think what I would say to answer this question is, yeah, just get a job. But if you can at least have some experience working for a doctor in private practice, I think that would be great. So if a day, a week, you have an experience working for somebody. And then here's the only thing that I've said this many times. If you work for a DSO or OSO in your covenant, you make sure they cannot restrict you at all of their office. Your covenant is only at the office that you work at or the main office that you work at. They can't block you from the state of California from working. So if you work in one area, hey, it's 5 miles from this area and it's up after 2 years. So
yeah, you know, that opens up a whole nother can of worms. We won't go down this road, but I was speaking to an expert in the field earlier today. It's just been conversation after conversation. This is a fascinating topic to me, and I'm a student of it, not an expert. But it was said that there are now 24 states who have ruled on the inadmissibility of non-competes in contracts.
Yeah.
And that's 24 states. That's a lot of states.
I don't even really do non-competes with my associates. I'm helped try, you know, our job in life is to help our employees be successful, right? And to help. Well, and I think that's our goal.
We've all heard this thing that's like, well, the non-compete's not actually enforceable, but it's like, well, it can put you in court. It can put you into a lawsuit. But if it's actually ruled, you know, objectively to not be permissible in states, how will that change how some of this happens, right? You know, so that'll be an interesting potential change with some of that. And I think that's to the detriment of corporate as well, if there's more turnover in those circumstances. But that happens in private practice too. And there's plenty of, I've heard horror stories on every side of all this. Okay, so your answer to that would be, I think is true, is there's a lot of student debt. You got to get a job. You got to work somewhere. What I would say is that your true north on your compass, why you joined orthodontics, what it was that you wanted to do, try to not let that change. And we all change as time goes, right? But does that make sense what I'm saying?
I guess what I would say is you're going to make much more money working at a DSO and maybe a little bit less working at an OSO, and then even less working as an associate for a doctor in private practice. But you will learn so much more working for a doctor in private practice. And if I could do my whole career over again, I literally tell patients this in the consultation room. I look them in the face and I say, if I could do my entire career over again, I would redo my first 10 years. Someone told me this great line, and I hope I'm not misquoting, that Dr. McNamara would say that you know you're a good orthodontist after 5 years of work. Well, I was not a good orthodontist, and I wasn't. And I made a lot of money, but I wasn't a great orthodontist. And I think if I could do things over again, I would at least part-time have worked for somebody in private practice.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, let's jump on. We got so many more questions to come. This is a tough one, but this is a question that I got, and a bunch of people talk about it, and there's the rumor mill, and I don't know if you'll know for sure, but I'm going to ask you anyway, and maybe some people in the comments can take the grenade here. But do you believe that OSO doctors get incentives when someone 100%. They refer signs up? Let me ask the question first. He's so ready for this one. Do they get incentives when someone they refer signs up or requests information, an LOI, whatever, about an OSO? You say 100%. Okay. I'll let that be your answer. I've heard so many variations around that.
Large incentive, by the way, too, which is why you see groupings of friends and similar practice types join the same corporation. I think one of the ways a doctor makes a little bit of an income during that year, where they will be making much less income working in their clinic, is to recruit other practices. And I actually think one of the values of a specific office would be who they know and who they can bring in. If I bring in Dr. Fagala, then maybe I can bring in all of his close friends into my corporation as well too.
Okay, the comments are saying to me that it is true.
Yeah, it's 100%.
And that it's probably, at least in some of the groups, based around a percentage. Which obviously the bigger the practice, the bigger the percentage. Now, I think that's fine. I think that's fair. That's business. I just don't think it's fine if it's not disclosed. I think that should be disclosed. I think just like everything else, I have a bias. Tonight I'm doing this podcast from my garage, and you know, Neon Canvas has helped support this and runs ads, and sometimes it's another company that runs ads, and that's how this works. That, you know, I'm not making a bunch of money, I promise you, doing this podcast. I do it because I love it. But I don't think there's any confusion there. I do think it's important that if there's a finder's fee and it's that substantial and that's what's motivating the behavior, which it is, you should probably tell people. Okay, let's talk about this. Another kind of similar thing is NDAs, non-disparagement agreements. I think it's a pretty common place in contractual business. But are those good or bad things for our profession? We have to think about the impact that this has down the stream from those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm indifferent about this. I think... You know, I don't have too much of a concern, but I will say this: there is a lot of overlap between some corporations and these scan centers that we are trying to distinguish ourselves from. There's a lot of like adapting these business practices. So, do I have an issue with them? No. I mean, I think that's fine. I think it helps actually probably both parties, the doctor who might be interested. So I think that's fine. I don't have a concern with NDAs as much as maybe someone else might.
Yeah, I think it's assumed. So I guess I don't either. I had some other people that were really concerned about it. I guess I would say that it would be nice if people could be honest and upfront and forthright about these things, and I understand why they can't. And I'm not going to fault anyone for that. And let me be clear, if it feels like very judgmental that, you know, a lot of my best friends have sold to corporate orthodontics, this is not a judgment on them. This is a conversation around it. And I get it. All right, let's move on to this question. I know we want to talk more and more and more about everyone, but let's jump into this. This is a big one, recap. And so recapitalization or an equity event is a big reason why some doctors sell their practice to an OSO. The biggest reason is you get a big bag of cash, right? Nothing wrong with that. We all like a big bag of cash every now and again. But the recap or the equity or the stock that's held, that's sort of, you know, it's the second bite of the apple, as it's discussed. And so how likely is it, in your opinion, that most OSOs or DSOs will experience a recap or equity event? And how lucrative will it be for the average doctor?
Okay, so I'm going to go over my experience at the DSO, and I'm going to share my very strong view. And I am not the person to talk about, because I haven't worked at an OSO, but I don't think anybody is getting their stock. It is Fugazi stock. No, I don't know. If you want your guaranteed money, it's going to come with your signing bonus. And I think in my experience at that DSO, nobody got that stock. There were a million ways where that nobody was able to truly cash out. So I don't understand it. It's confusing. And I'm not sure that I would hold my hat on that. You know, when they purchase your practice, they're going to purchase it. So it's not 15 million, it's 70% of 15 million, because you have to have some of that stock equity skin in the game. They don't want you to totally disengage. Whether you ever recuperate that 30% in stock, I don't know. I don't think so. And I am very aware that I am well outside my area of expertise, but I don't see anybody riding off into the sunset with stock options.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard of some who have had recap events or equity events and have done well in those moments. And I think that, you know, there are going to be people for whom this was the absolute best decision, better than if they'd held on. And then for some, it won't be. Again, I think it kind of comes back to that just sort of common sense, is that at some point the merry-go-round stops spinning and someone's left on it. I think that's the case. And I don't feel like that's unfair to say, like, you know, I mean, assuming it fails, or assuming that it falters, you know,
the doctors are going to get paid last. I mean, the way this works is private equity is going to get paid first. The people at the highest level of the corporation will get paid second if there's not debt. I just don't know how these stock options ever truly cash out. And I don't know if there's cash to cash out.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let's move on to this one. Here's a good question that I got is, if a doctor who sells their practice to an OSO wants to stay on after their initial contract ends, their initial contract being, you know, 3-5, I know I've read some about them pushing for more like 7-year. I think that's important. It's that continuity is an important factor in all this. But yeah, if they want to stay on after that initial contract, will they be able to negotiate a new higher salary? I think this is important because a doctor goes from making, as a private practice doctor with a nice practice, you know, $1.5 million a year take home, easy, to $350,000 a year. What about year 6? Do they want to keep making that?
Yeah, I think you told, so I think absolutely I was able to renegotiate my salary at the DSO. Actually, very quickly, I was able to renegotiate it when I walked in and said, well, this is much different than what I thought it would be. So I think if you walk into an office and, you know, it's busier or harder work, or you are producing, I hate talking about that kind of stuff, but if you are achieving the goals that they set for you and you're doing well and you're helping that practice grow, yeah, I think you can negotiate. I will say this for the young residents who are looking for work, going back to my own mistakes. I talked about how I over-negotiated my first contract. And what I will tell you is, if you find a job, whether it's DSO, OSO, or in private practice that you really connect with, you really like, this is a good place for me. Don't worry about the salary. Like, don't worry about the salary. Just start there, because you'll be able to renegotiate the salary the next year and get what you want. I always give the story of an associate who I paid a first year salary to, but within 6 months I paid a third year salary to, and just immediately gave a raise because I said, well, you're working at such a high level, I need to just pay you what you're worth. So yes, you can negotiate. You can negotiate quickly. But my humble suggestion would be, listen, my wife's an attorney, and she would tell you your only power of negotiation is with that initial contract. And I would actually, I have a different approach. I don't really kind of agree with that. I would say just work, build equity within that corporation, and then maybe you'll have no problem getting a raise after 6 or 12 months. My humble suggestion.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with your wife, the lawyer there. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I think maybe a mixture of the two.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Negotiate some. Why not? You know. So, But you're right. I think if you prove yourself to be indispensable, that should bear out. And at the point at which it doesn't, you're going to be going somewhere else anyway. So, all right. So, hey, can we do a quick message from our sponsor? I know you weren't expecting that, but we're going to. You could take a drink of water if you want to go run to the bathroom really quickly. But I'm going to simplify it to this. It's about Neon Canvas. We support 200 orthodontic practices and more in all 50 states, and we have orthodontists that trust us to take the stress of marketing off their shoulders, to drive new patient numbers, and we're ready to do the same for you. Go to neoncanvas.com. We'll do a free digital audit for you, and we will help support your practice. Okay, let's come to this. This is now, Neil, the section of this interview, which has gone famously. This is going swimmingly, famously. It's fantastic. I hope people are enjoying it. What comes next? I think that's a good question. What's the end of this story? You know?
Yeah. So,
oh, well.
Go ahead.
All right.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
this is like when you're on the phone. No, you go. No, I'll go. All right. So given the current high interest rates, we know that this is like a unique time, at least in the last 10, 15 years. It does seem probable, like just to get serious for a second, that some orthodontic groups might struggle to stay afloat. We've seen some hints of that. And I don't want to name specific names if that's okay with you. But let's be honest, if that happens, and they'd probably get reacquired, that'll get shuffled around, they'll reconfigure, whatever. It's not going to just like, you know, in 5 years, there won't be zero corporate orthodontic practices. That's silly to think that. But what are the implications for the patients and the practices affected by such closures or acquisitions?
Yeah, so in our area, this has definitely happened. Smaller corporations, but corporations have private practices sold to corporations. And then after a few years, these corporations went under and they sold back to private practice. So it's very interesting to see what has kind of happened. So we've experienced it, at least in our area, and we're in a very affluent, we're in the most affluent area in Loudoun County. So it can happen anywhere. And I think we should expect to see, offices starting to close and resold back into private practice. I think that's expected.
Yeah. And probably gobbled up by other OSOs or DSOs.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if you know the answer. And if you don't, just say, I don't know. At the point of that happening, does your contract change? Does it have to be renegotiated? What do you think? Do you know?
I just don't know. I would assume the contract's terminated, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I mean, I have, you know, some good close friends that during the time of COVID, their contract was changed, and that wasn't even at the point of a sale. It was just, hey, we're changing this, you know, and so then they exited. So I think there's that possibility. Again, that these are, you know, anecdotal examples, but yeah. Okay, so maybe interest rates will come down. We don't know. Okay, so let's shift on into this one. This was the most common question, or at least the most common analogy people gave was, how do we make sure that orthodontics doesn't end up like pharmacy or medicine? My brother's a pharmacist. In those situations, you could say that decisions are made by businessmen or hospital administrators and not by doctors. And customer service is often an afterthought. Let's just be honest. If I go to the doctor, if I go to the pharmacist, it is not the same experience as when I go to the orthodontist, at least as I see it. So here's my question. It's a long question. How do the doctors involved in leadership at OSOs make sure that their organizations are making decisions that are in the best interest of their patients, team members, and orthodontists?
Well, so a couple things. So I don't think it's all bad. I don't think corporations like are all bad. I mean, I stop, that's not how I feel at all. I actually think... So I talked to you about this before, Kyle. I think every area needs Walmart, right? One of my favorite books is a book called The Life and Death of the Great American Cities by a woman named Jane Jacobs. And Jane Jacobs was like a political protester who really fought against highways being built within New York City. They wanted to build highways through Greenwich Village. And she would fight and say what made New York interesting was it didn't have Walmart. It had small shops. And you remember New York because of DeFaro's Pizza, not because of Walmart. That's why you go to New York City. So I think, but there's value to having a corporate practice there too. There's those conveniences. So I think some aspects of corporate is okay. And I think that's fine. But I don't think you can expect corporations to regulate themselves. What is king is collection, and you can argue that if you make money, you can take better care of patients. But a corporation will always focus on collection and EBITDA. At no point will a regional manager come into your practice and talk to you about second molar detailing. They're going to talk to you about case starts and collection and percentage growth, and it's all going to be about money. That's how you're going to be judged. That's how you're going to view your success. So I don't think we can rely on corporations to regulate themselves. And I think it's going to come down to who we sell our practices to. I think it's going to come down to the private doctor.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And, you know, I know we've got lots of, you know, even people who've started corporate orthodontic, orthodontic OSOs, goodness gracious, can't even say the words, that are watching this. And so I would just say, yeah, this will be an interesting one to ask of someone in corporate orthodontics to see what their answer is. So I would just say this, like, if there's any chance that it ends up where orthodontics is like pharmacy or medicine, I don't want that. So I'm challenging whoever's in leadership of OSOs to not do that. And I know a lot of them, and I know they would say, that's not what we want. And so I hope not,
But orthodontists aren't making the decisions. It's going to be MBAs and JDs. Those are the people that make the decisions. And those are the people that are going to come into your office. And as more private equity gets involved, the orthodontic influence of orthodontic corporations will get less.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's go on into this one. I hope you're still enjoying this, people. They're staying with us. They're staying with us, Neil. Okay, are we still out there? Are people still watching this thing? I hope so. All right, so on to this question. This was someone that he's an orthodontist. He recently sold his practice to an OSO. And let me just say this, for what it's worth, I asked several people to be on this thing, and it's a hard topic. So kudos to Neil for doing this. And there's a lot of people for whom they wanted to be on here. They had a good voice, and they just didn't feel comfortable doing it. I had one doctor that has worked in an OSO/DSO for 15 years and is tickled pink. You know, so again, there's so many different stories and so many different voices that could be on this. But this is an orthodontist, again, had sold to a very, very popular OSO. And he said that when doctors ask him, because naturally they're going to ask, you know, their friend that just sold, if they should sell their practice to an OSO, here is his kind of rubric for that. And I think it's maybe a fair way, and you'll see if you think so. He says there are three good reasons why you should sell. And let me be the first to say, there are definitely colleagues for whom I have immense respect for and that it was the right decision for them for sure. And so there's different ways to approach this topic. You know, we're looking at it as private practicing orthodontist. You might look at it as someone who works in corporate. There's also the very personal decision that is unique to you, okay? And so maybe this applies. You want a pile of cash now. That's one reason. Two is you want to retire. So obviously at the end of your career, and I think it was Scott Law that said, because he's watching, he said, everyone, you know, dislikes OSOs until they want to sell their practice. I mean, the last few years, that's not an unfair statement, okay? You want to retire or you have health issues, and that's, you know, it's a way to get out. There are some practices that are so big that who's going to buy them? Okay, so I think those are fair. And then number three, you want to move. And I've known some people that, you know, going through divorce, they need to move, whatever. Otherwise, though, he doesn't recommend it. Okay, so those are his three reasons. Otherwise, you know, is that fair? Is there something we're forgetting?
No, I don't know if it's fair. I think it's you have every right to do whatever you want with your life and your practice. You are obligated to your family before you are obligated to your profession. And I think if your husband or wife looks at you and says, we need this. Yeah. I mean, come on, like, listen, you know, my wife says the opposite, but yeah, I'm not here to judge that for anything. Here's what I will just kind of say, because I think there's kind of a question I don't know why a young orthodontist sells to an OSO. I know why a 55-year-old orthodontist sells to an OSO, but brother, if you're 40 and you sell, your foot is on the pedal. It's just about to happen. I don't know. I don't understand. I'm a little bit confused, but again, there's a lot of reasons why someone might. And I think, and I would not judge anybody why they sell. Nobody should do that. I hope nobody judges anybody why they would do that.
A lot of people do. A lot of people do.
It's more confusing to me why someone is selling their practice in their 40s. And that's what I would say. I understand that those are the offices the OSOs want and will pay the most for, but even still, the numbers don't add up to me. And I'm more confused why a 40-year-old sells than a 55-year-old or 60-year-old.
Yeah. And again, there's always reasons that we don't necessarily know. I think generally from a financial perspective, if you run the numbers out 10, 15, 20 years, you should keep your practice. I mean, the math is very, very apparent. I think that there was probably some element of like a gold rush, I think, among some people, you know, my contemporaries. Some of them got really incredible deals that I don't think will exist in the future. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that kind of go into this conversation. But I guess I'm, you know, at this moment speaking to residents just to say that, you know, if you can end up in a place where you own your practice or you partner in a practice, it is a really great situation. And you will not regret being in that situation.
The goal should not be to open your practice and sell it at 45. That should not be the goal. And I think that should not be the goal for the majority of us, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Someone said FOMO. Again, I don't know who these people are, but you know, all right, this is great. I think this is going really well. Okay. Let's get on into question 16. We have just a few left and then we'll wrap up. So let's see. Okay. We aren't all the same. Not all OSOs and DSOs are created equally, but let's sort of generalize here for a second, if you will. In your opinion, what type of orthodontist would you say is corporate ortho generally a bad fit for? Then I'm going to ask you the same, but a good fit. What do you think it's a bad fit for?
This is not an easy question because you can't say, well, someone who is a killer should be in private practice. And, you know, I think you're not a good fit in corporate ortho if you are someone who is going to be stubborn and, I think you have to be willing to be a company person. I think you have to kind of be a good soldier. I really do. I think I don't really know what I would say a bad fit in any corporation would be someone who was flying solo. And it doesn't mean they're great in private practice either, but I don't know if it has anything to do with temperament or anything like that. I really do think you have to be someone who works well with others if you're going to work at a corporation. And if you are someone who is a team person, you will do well in both settings, but you'll do well in a corporate setting.
Okay. What about, maybe you just answered that, who it's a good fit for, I guess. Yeah. Let's go into this private practice. Same question. You know, and not everyone wants to be a private practice owner, and that's totally fine. I think when we look at the unique challenges right now for the younger generation, there is an increased burden of student debt. That could be another podcast. Why is school so freaking expensive? There is greater competition now that exists around acquiring practices. You mentioned that earlier. There's also, this is a sort of a cultural commentary, but there is a desire among younger generations to live in bigger cities or to wait longer to settle down. Fewer are married than before, and so that kind of plays in all this. I want to go to big cities. Younger generations are more transient. They move from city to city more frequently. These are not like offensive things. These are just things I've read and that I think are true. And so practice ownership becomes decreasingly realistic, just to say that as a commentary. All that being said, what type of orthodontist is private practice a good fit for? What type of orthodontist is it a bad fit for?
Well, I think, listen, the best part of, and I'm not trying to not answer the question. I'm really trying to answer these questions very head on. I think the best part and the hardest part of being an orthodontist, is being a practice owner. You know, it's Sunday and you're going to be mopping the floors if no one's there. And there's times where I'm shoveling the snow on the parking lot. There's times where payroll's about to hit in a few hours and I'm transferring funds and all the stresses that we all know that we do as private owners. I think there's something very, you have a lot of pride in owning your own practice. And I think, that's where it's appealing. And I think for some people it's less appealing. They don't care for those types of things. They enjoy having a paycheck without any bills. And there's a lot of value in that. Trust me, working at a DSO, it was really nice for 7 years to take a very large paycheck home and not have any expenses. So I don't know if it's a temperament issue. I don't think it's about that, but I think the best part of being in private practice is to be your own boss. That's also the hardest part too.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, totally. I totally agree. I want to comment on this because I think it's great and I want to make this point. I can see who this is. This is Scott Law. I know Scott. Hello, Scott. Scott is in better shape than I'll ever be, and he has a better mustache than I'll ever have. And you can't grow out a red mustache. But he says he's looking forward to Jamie's counter comments. This is great stuff. Appreciate the discussion. Thank you. This is a common objection that I've heard. Let's not forget that many of the most ardent OSO naysayers have been told no when they wanted to join sell to an OSO. So that may be Scott's experience. I'll just say I've not tried to sell to an OSO for what that's worth, if anyone's thinking that. So I think that could be true, and it could also not be true. And so I it's not the spirit that I'm trying to bring to it. And I'm not trying to start an argument or make it personal, but I do think that's a common thing that I hear from friends is sort of a criticism. And again, the goal is just to have these conversations, start these conversations. We all have our different perspectives. Okay, Neil, let's shift into this. We're almost there, buddy. In your opinion, where do you see OSOs in 5 to 10 years? What do you think? You're not a future teller or fortune teller.
I think they'll be about the same. I think it's a little bit too soon. I think 5 to 10 years may not be long enough. You think longer than that? It'll be interesting. I don't know, and I am in no position to know this stuff. This is well beyond my understanding. But you know, corporate dentistry has been around for a very long time, and it seems to be hard for them to get past that 20% number. So we'll see. And I don't know if the exponential growth that we saw a few years ago is going to continue.
So you're not prepared to say, like, with all scan centers will close or all bird scooters will be eradicated?
Oh, I don't think all corporations will close. I do think all scan centers will close, but no, I think corporations are here. They're here to stay, and I think they're going to fit a market share.
Yeah, I think that's a sensible answer. And like you said, it remains to be seen. What do we know? You know. All right, into one of the last questions. In your opinion, is corporate orthodontics overall good or bad for the profession of orthodontics?
Well, I think this question has been brought up many times, and I think, listen, this is a hard question to answer without hurting people. But I think even those who sell their practice know that selling their office benefits them, rightfully so. But it probably overall hurts the model of orthodontics, where we have associates purchase a private practice. So is it good or bad for the profession of orthodontics? I mean, that is a question that I can't answer. But I will say that I think it hurts young doctors who want to purchase practices in the future. And what has happened with the growth of corporate orthodontics has been a more challenging landscape for young residents hoping to purchase existing practices. And I think that is bad for orthodontics.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it at that, because that's a tough question. And I guess the only caveat I would add is that, and I've heard this, I had so many conversations on both sides of this whole thing, especially the last couple of weeks. It's how many other decisions do we make where we're so worried about the profession of orthodontics? To which I would say, and I would challenge, well, we should be keeping that as a pretty big part of.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we would say Invisalign was bad for orthodontics, and now, listen, clear aligners are going to become a major part of orthodontics. I don't know. I just know that it's a harder landscape for new grads.
Yeah. I mean, I'll go as far as to say I think I'm more comfortable with the idea on average of an orthodontist running and making those decisions than for potentially a private equity group. I mean, I think that's fair. I think if there's a chance that this ends up like pharmacy or medicine, I have to keep coming back to that. I don't love that. And, you know, when it comes to can I take my kids to a privately owned dentist, I tend to prefer that. I mean, I think those are things that I can say that are fair. Now, I don't know that equates to that it's bad for the profession or whatever. I don't know that it's that serious necessarily. And I think a lot of these groups have succeeded and will continue to succeed. But I think that for me is at least a bit of a prevailing win on how I view this, let's say. And I'm a private practice guy. So again, that's our perspective is like, we like what we do, we're proud of it, and so on and so forth. Is that fair?
I think this, when someone sells, it benefits the person, rightfully so, and their family, rightfully so, they don't owe anything to the profession. I don't think that's the case. But I think if you're asking, does selling your practice to a business benefit the profession as a whole? Well, I think we know, I think most people could answer that.
All right, before I go to the last question, I have to call this comment out. Orthodontics as a profession has fallen from the top 10 in U.S. News and World Report rankings to number 73. I'd love to hear why this group thinks this happened. Because it's U.S. News and World Report, and they don't know what they're talking about. Have you seen this article, Neil?
No. Nobody loves themselves as much as an orthodontist does. I don't agree with that. We are. If we're not number one, I don't know what else. Nobody hates their jobs more than attorneys do, and nobody loves their job more than orthodontists do.
Well, I commented to someone else who shared that, and there were some jobs on that list that were ranked above us that were crazy. High school football coach was ranked above orthodontist. And look, I love high school football coaches, but give me a break. All right, so here we go. We're getting into the last question. There's a high school football coach out there watching like, what did I do? You know? All right, so this is something I'm passionate about, and I think there's a chance that this gets missed and all this, and this is why this has been a tough topic. This is why originally it was formulated as having both sides equally represented, and I was going to be the moderator. That had to change. And again, I have to give full credit to Neil for being willing. I mean, he was up and at him. He was like, let's just do it. And we understand that it makes it feel a little bit uneven. Consider this as a pair to the future conversation that will be from the corporate orthodontic perspective. Understand that we understand that. We accept, you know, Neil's willing to go first here and have this conversation first. So again, all the kudos in the world to him. But ultimately, I want everyone to get this. I am passionate about keeping the profession of orthodontics together. I think that's very, very important. Regardless of what you think, regardless of if you think it's good or bad for the profession, or whether you're in corporate ortho and you're in private practice, I'm good friends with so many people in corporate ortho, and I want to make sure that as a profession, we don't become pharmacy and medicine. And if pharmacists and medical doctors out there, what do we do? Well, you know, your profession isn't as good as ours. And I think part of that, to be fair, is staying on the same page as much as we can in the form of the AAO, to be honest. And so I want to harken back to this. 2014, Smile Direct Club was founded. Nearly 10 years after, it finally closed its doors in December. Neil called that. He prognosticated that. When SDC started, that was the time that I best remember in my profession or my career of seeing the profession come together around a single issue. My fear of corporate ortho has always been, and I said this, I pulled this straight out of the script I did about 3 or 4 years ago with Scott and Jamie and Anil and Chris Benson. My fear is that corporate ortho will act as a means by which orthodontists see each other more as competitors than as colleagues. And that's borrowing from your book there, Neil, the colleagues and competitors thing. I also fear that it might eventually lead to membership issues for the AAO at a time when a unified front is very important. So here's the question, finally. How do we avoid this dissension and this difference and this spreading apart and splitting apart? And how do we continue working together in a unified way as orthodontists?
Yeah, I think it's great. I know we've talked about my two favorite orthodontists. We've talked about Christian Groth and Maz Moshiri, two of my closest friends who both work in corporations. And there is not a lecture that I haven't given where I don't mention both their names and talk about how much I look up to these two doctors. And they are thriving in their corporations, and they are really the epitome of orthodontics. I really do think that highly of them both. And they're both in two different corporations and doing great. So I think we are more similar. And I think the issue that, you know, in our minds, when we talk about our arch enemy up the street, I think if we took a deep breath, we're pretty similar. We have kids, we're the same age, we have the same struggles. We got to go home and make sure our spouse is happy and our bills are paid and all those stresses that we go through. So I think if we always remember that we have the same stresses and the same challenges and the same headaches, and then I think that will bring us together. I will tell you, you made a great point, and Scott has been great working with the AAO, and I know he's like in daily communication. And it was a concern for me that corporations could take their ball and go home and have their own meetings and their own, and they have it, and they've done the opposite. And I think we're very grateful for that. And I think that's the commitment you talked about toward the profession. And that's great. The more of that is great. So I think, listen, we have to resist the tendency That competition, that fight in us that makes us successful, when it starts to become unhealthy, when it starts to become one versus one, we have to kind of back away and say, wait a minute, guys, there's a lot of ways to do this. And I've not done perfect orthodontics. I don't run a perfect business. There's a lot of things that I can learn. And I think if we remember that we're more similar than different, I think everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, I like that. I don't think I can say it any better than that. So kudos to you. I think the only thing I would add is that there are people working at the AO to ensure that that happens. And it's not just about the AO. I think there's a lot more to our profession than just that. But that's probably the easiest way to sort of talk about it. And so I think that's a huge goal. And so I think I would challenge those that sell their practice to stay engaged in the profession.
Yeah.
Yes. And I don't say that in a condescending way, because look, there's private practice people that don't go to any meetings too, you know, so it's not, again, these arguments work both ways. And I've had periods, partly due to mental health issues and other things, like where I've leaned out of my role as a leader in the practice. And so I think it's contingent on all of us to remember why we did this. We ultimately did it, at least we told people in interviews, is we want to help people, right? And we want to do all these great and lofty things. And yeah, we did it so we could make money and because it's a great profession. And I did it because I'm OCD and I love getting things just exactly straight. But I think we have an obligation as professionals and professionals in, I think, the greatest specialty and the greatest profession on earth, I really think that, to do well by it. And I think it was, you think about 100 years ago, people taking a boat so they could learn from Edward Engel, right? That's crazy to me. And you put it into context in today's world, and, you know, we may not be willing to walk across the street to do something good, right? So, or to further our education or to work on being better at the things that we do or to be a better leader. And I think that's important. And so I think part of this conversation is being committed to that as a profession that should be seen as something special and that we need to maintain as special. So let's end it with that. I look forward to part two of this. Neil, you did an awesome job. I've got a couple things to read. So those of you out there, stick around if you can. I have a couple things to read. I want to invite you to a couple things, and then I've got one thing to talk about that pertains to Neil, so stay with us. I want to remind you that we're just 2 months out from the AAO. It's early this year. And sometimes it's this time of year, but it's in New Orleans, which is a great place. I've heard people talking about, oh, New Orleans is scary. Stop that. We're going to go. We're going to have a good time. I'm speaking. I'm guessing, Neil, are you speaking as well? Of course. Right?
I'll be
speaking. They put us opposite each other last time. That's not fair. But I hope they don't do that again this year. My band Relapse is playing, and we're throwing an enormous party. It's Friday, May the 3rd. It's the night before the AAO begins. It's called Orthomania. Yes, it will have a wrestling theme. Yes, it will be amazing. It is my birthday, literally my 40th birthday that very night. So please plan to be there in New Orleans on Friday. You got to come. Tickets are going to go on sale soon. Neon Canvas, I've been working. My special project is an app called Contour. We're going to announce that coming up very soon. I guess I'm announcing it right now. And we're going to launch it at the AAO. It's an iPhone app. It's also going to be on Android for those of you who have the little green text bubbles that I can't stand. But I hope you'll look forward to learning more about Contour. It's going to be amazing. And this is for Neil. So if you enjoyed something Neil said tonight, and I'm sure you did, then I highly recommend that you join him on his JCO webinar. This is Wednesday, February 28th. If you're watching this live, that is two nights from tonight. If you're watching this later, you probably missed it. But it's 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's an AMA, which stands for Ask Me Anything, and that's with Dr. Neil Kravitz. You'll be able to ask him any clinical or orthodontic business-related questions that you so desire. Please don't ask him about corporate orthodontics. He's tired of those questions. He answered all of them tonight. JCO webinars, they are free for subscribers, or they're $100 for non-subscribers. And you can sign up for a subscription for as little as $239 a year. So do the math. Go to a couple of these and you'll make your money back. It's also an excellent subscription. The digital, I get the print version because I'm an old man inside of a young man's body, right? I like the printed off version. And this is my favorite magazine as a resident, for what it's worth. I read it back then and I still read it. And we pass it around the office. But you can subscribe at jco-online.com/subscribe or just Google it. You're going to get one CE credit for an additional $10. And go sign up on their website. for the CE event. It's just two nights from tonight. So go to jco-online.com and you can sign up for that Wednesday, February 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern. All right. I want to thank everyone who's listening to this on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are sold, on YouTube, whatever. Please subscribe. Give us a five-star review. Leave some nice comments, I hope. I got to be honest, Neil, the comment section was on fire tonight, and I think that's because it was you. So thank you.
I did my best. This was a hard – I did the best I could.
You did awesome. Please, everyone, be kind to Neil. You know, there'll be some people who didn't like it, and, you know, you can't make everyone happy, but I thought you did awesome. It's a tightrope. So thank you, though, for spending your time. You didn't have to spend your Monday night with us, but you did, and I appreciate it. Thanks again to Dr. Neil Kravitz. What a guy. Thanks to Alan, Scott, Kayla, and the TDO team at Neon Canvas. And special thanks to tonight's sponsor, who happens to be Neon Canvas. And from all of us here at the Digital Orthodontist, I haven't said this in so long, but I'm Dr. Kyle Fagala, signing off. And I'll be back in the comments to talk to all of you. There's so many nice people saying nice things. I appreciate you. Saints are going to win the Super Bowl next year. You heard it here first. Who dat? That has to be Chris Feldman. The Rolling Stones are playing, yep, at Jazz Fest. I know. I'm excited about that. Go Grizz. Thank you. Best podcast, case closed. Fantastic. I appreciate you all. Let's play out our song. And you know what? I think Neil and I are going to go have a little aperitif and take a nap, right? Is that fair to say? Yeah. All right. Thank you, Neil. Thank you, guys. Have a great night. Good night.